Within the deepest recesses of the darkest corners, in the dingiest of libraries, on refectory tables, within dens of debauchery, places of erudition, libraries, bookstores, bedrooms, living rooms, motel rooms, majestic halls illuminated by dim light bulbs, these 21 lip blockers did read again. Five nominees, 21 lip blockers, the Lit Blog Co-op.
Five
nominees and a blackjack to peruse their inners. Ladies and gentlemen, readers of all deviant persuasions, including vanilla, please join us as we momentarily preempt Mr. Segundo the next round of the LBC Podcast.
I believe in the Lit Blog Co-op. The Lit Blog Co-op has made my fortune, and I raised my twin daughters in the Lit Blog Co-op fashion. I gave them freedom, but I taught them never to dishonor their family. One of them found a boyfriend, not an Italian, but another attorney who worked in my firm. She went to the movies with him. She starved herself. I didn't complain. 2 months ago, she moved in with her sister. They made her eat meals, and she tried to take advantage of them. She kept her honor, but she reacted like an animal. She couldn't even weep because of the pain. Oh, but I wept. Why did I weep? She was the light of my life, beautiful girl. Now, she will never be beautiful again. I went to the hospital, like a good American. My two daughters laughed at me. The world sentenced them to 3 years in therapy. Suspended therapy. Suspended therapy. Freudian. I laid down on the couch like a fool. And that bastard therapist, he smiled at me. Then I said to my wife, for justice, we must go to Cassia Corja.
So I am here with Cassia Crozier, who nominated Gina Frangello's My Sister's Continent as this spring's, is it spring? Yes, it is spring. As we were just discussing, nominee for the Lit Blog Co-op. Cassia, how are you doing?
Great, very good. It's a wonderful morning.
Oh, yes, it is. It is quite. Is it? You're in L.A. then, right?
Yeah, I'm in L.A. It's a little bit overcast, but it's been very warm. It's gorgeous.
Okay, cool.
It makes you just so happy to live here. So there is a syndrome that we have here called Southern California Weather Wimp.
Uh-huh.
It's an official syndrome where if it goes below a certain temperature, we're freezing. We don't know how to handle it.
Yeah, it's very true. Well, you know, are you a native Cal? I'll talk more about this later. But Anyway, to the book, because we're both chatterboxes, I see. So what was it about the Frangello book that sort of struck your fancy and made it be the kind of nominee, so to speak, here?
The violence. At every turn, it's all, you know, it's like you usually think of sex as this beautiful, loving thing, but it was really just never a happy situation.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, you know, on every turn, everybody was hurting each other in the way that they knew best.
There's almost a sadistic impulse here in terms of choosing the book.
Yeah, in a way, because I had a friend who also read this, and she's going, I can't believe people do this.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, what is wrong with me that I think it's normal that people hurt each other that way? That, you know, you kind of expect it, and, you know, you use the weapons you have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. It's like people, I guess because this topic is not so much written about, that people are sort of shocked that it actually happens, because it generally happens, as it's presented in this book, too, in very sort of private quarters.
Well, that's the other thing. I was thinking about that this morning. You know, they hide the fact that the father has AIDS,
mm-hmm.
cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in 1994, 1998, you know, period of the book, that there wasn't the same social stigma, yet it's very, you know, domestic violence, you know, incest, all of these things. Just the fact that, you know, your teenage daughter is using drugs.
Yeah.
You don't tell people that. Everybody knows, but you never admit it.
Why do you think literary fiction shies away from this kind of topic?
Oh, well, it is a woman's topic,
mm-hmm.
in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And literary fiction this book was written by a woman, and normally when you think about how a woman writes about these topics, it's very delicate.
Yeah.
And there was nothing delicate about this. She just, like, picked it up and leaped over the cliff with it. And I think that it's very hard to write about incest. It's very hard to write about masochism, because when you get down to it, there's a lot of masochism with all these characters, because it is private. And, you know, especially in literary fiction, you don't like to get too intimate with your characters.
Now, I wanted to ask you, this seemed very, very much inspired by Margaret Atwood in the way that it was sort of structured. It reminded me very much of Cat's Eye and The Blind Assassin. I was wondering if you got sort of an Atwood vibe from this.
Well, if anything, it would be The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
Because, did you read that?
Yeah, I've read a lot of Atwood. Yes, I have read
and
that.
And it's always this, you know, woman is a victim and then finding power in her own way sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and I guess that's the one, because, you know, early in Handmaid's Tale, where you've got the birth scene, so they're describing the birthing chair. That's a really violent thing to me.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, the way they set that up, where, you know, this woman is just a thing. She's not even a person. She's just a thing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You know, there was a lot of violence there.
Thank you very much, Cassia.
Okay, I am here with Gina Frangello, author of My Sister's Cottage, which is one of the LBC nominees. Gina, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well.
Okay, we apparently may be rasping to each other, as you were pointing out earlier, because I've been talking continuously and you've got some sort of affliction or flu or something.
A little laryngitis.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry to hear that. But we'll do the best we can. Well, Gina, thanks so much for talking. I wanted to, first of all, start in talking about My Sister's Continent. There is, I understand that Freud's Dora study is the model for this and an inspiration. I was wondering if you can elaborate on how this kind of led you into the book, or when you discovered it during the course of writing.
Well, it was really interesting because I actually had been writing about these characters for quite a number of years prior to even reading the case study. I had done a series of short stories called Body Parts that were mainly from Kendra's first-person point of view. And then I was simultaneously teaching a class at University of Illinois at Chicago called The Hysterics in Literature.
Oh.
And I just made up the class. I have a background in psych, and I thought it would be interesting. So I decided that I was going to teach Freud's Dora case study as the first text. I was going to teach it like a novella.
Uh-huh.
And the reason why I chose it was because a lot of the French feminist theorists had written extensively about it, so I figured I could do some accompanying theory work with the class as well, and then we would lead into novels that had various hysterical characters, you know, King Lear, what have you. And as I was reading the fragment of an analysis of a case of hysteria, which is the Dora case study, I was just pretty much blown away by the similarities structurally, plot-wise, to the two families that I'd been writing about in the short story series. And I started getting this idea that, you know, I could use it as some kind of a model, similarly to the way that that Jane Smiley had used Lear for 1,000 Acres, where there wouldn't be any direct references to the case study or to Freud in the actual book, but it would follow this sort of, you know, parallel plot line. It would be a contemporary retelling. And so I just started playing with it, and a novel grew out of it.
Now, were there any other sort of psychoanalytical references aside from Dora? You mentioned this kind of interesting class, and maybe I think I had read some interview where you had mentioned that you had used certain kinds of psychoanalytical theories in the 90s.
Yes. What I wanted to do, a lot of the theory, the feminist theory that was that had been written about the Dora case study, talked about the issue of Freud and seduction theory and Freud's renunciation of his patients' claims of abuse. And I had actually been a practicing counselor in the early 90s when it was the exact opposite climate, basically, where, I mean, pretty much, you know, the thing was, you know, these claims of repressed memory, and everybody was allegedly a victim of sexual abuse. And so the pendulum had swung so completely oppositely that it was kind of a fascinating time that, you know, basically, while, of course, I and pretty much most people practicing counseling at that time were no longer on the boat with Freud's way of thinking, it seemed to me that things had gone kind of hysterically in the opposite direction. And so I wanted
the book to be a little bit of a dialogue between these different types of theories, you know, between repressed memory, between, you know, basically Oedipal theories, just the different characters in the book sort of representing different outlooks where the reader could come up with their own conclusion at the end, and it could be interpreted basically whatever way the reader's predilections were. So
I caught a sort of kind of, I'm not sure if you meant this as an homage or anything, but the sort of psychoanalyst who is there to kind of assess a woman's problem, even though it's outside of his expertise, reminded me very much of like the opening of Erica Jong's Fear of Flying. I'm not sure if this might have been an influence in any way. Of course, back in the 70s, psychoanalysts were all the rage, but
right.
Specifically, she used, she kind of like, you know, that the major thing about that book is that she used psychoanalysts to sort of, why are you discussing these issues that you know nothing about? And that was the whole sort of one of the shticks of the book, you know?
It may certainly have been. I mean, I've read the book. I read it probably when I was about 21 years old, so I wasn't really consciously thinking about it anymore by the time that I was writing this book, but, you know, it certainly was a book that at one point in my life, you know, made an impact on me, so I'm sure that subconsciously it could have, you know, been some kind of an homage there going on, definitely.
Okay. Well, what was curious to me is that Kirby's irritable bowel syndrome almost disappears by the end of the book. I guess this sort of seemed to be one component of the unreliable narrator of Kirby, and part of me sort of suspects that since these papers are in the psychoanalyst's hands, that maybe even the psychoanalyst might have had some bit of a part in forging some of the details. I was wondering to what level, I mean, there seem to be a lot of ambiguities in this particular book, and I was wondering if you could kind of elaborate, I mean, how reliable really is this book, or is it unreliable ambiguity underneath unreliable ambiguity? Some sort of like, you know, excavating Troy here almost.
Well, I definitely didn't intend anybody to be the definitively reliable character, that's for sure. I mean, just even in terms of the book's outcome, you know, Kendra has one perspective, Kirby has another perspective on what happened with her father. The father, Dr. Friedland, everyone has their own perspective. So in that case, I mean, I wanted there to be different ways of reading the book. On the one hand, Kirby's irritable bowel syndrome starts to sort of dissipate as she... Hold on one second, I'm sorry, I'm going to hand off the baby here and actually get myself upstairs where it's quieter.
Okay.
You know, Kirby's irritable bowel syndrome could be coming up while it could be clearing up while she is simultaneously sort of discovering her own sexuality, mm-hmm. and so she may have less need for her hysterical symptoms. So it could be read that way. On the other hand, it certainly could be read in the sense that, you know, she really may not have been completely reliably reporting her symptoms all along. She certainly does lie to her therapist a great deal. She lies to Eris. It's, you know, she and her sister lie to each other. It's not impossible that she lies to the reader, too.
Well, there was also one other component to this book that was interesting to me, and that was two things, actually. You have these epigraphs throughout the book, which sort of suggests that there's a form of wisdom that the characters don't necessarily have access to within these quotes. There's that. And there's also these oblique references to a variety of current events, to Kosovo, to CNN reports of blurring about murders and the like. And the sense I'm getting here is that, you know, there's a distinct way that the text serves to kind of, like, I guess, underscore this priority of wisdom that is not necessarily there. I was wondering how much of this might have been designed by you, or if you can comment upon this.
Well, definitely, it's interesting. I definitely wouldn't want to say that the novel has some kind of underlying reality that the characters are smart enough to figure out or anything like that. That's actually a little bit of one of my pet peeves in books. So that's not exactly what my intention was, but I did want to speak to sort of like multiple cultural realities that, you know, that small things in ordinary life echo. You know, I mean, it struck me that since I was setting the novel at the same time as, you know, the Clinton impeachment trial, that just seemed really interesting to me, the issue of, you know, what is sort of, who's a perpetrator, who's guilty, what is sexual deviance, all of these things that were going on in the culture at the same time as Kirby is wrestling with these things with regard to her sister's relationship with Michael Kelsey, that, you know, the sisters are trying to figure out what respectively happened to each of them with regard to the father. And, you know, just having a larger backdrop on when the Kennedy wedding was called off, that seems sort of a perfect thing that I couldn't resist sticking in there as Kirby's wedding was being called off. So just sort of echoing the larger culture when talking about sort of this one family and their fairly small lives, their insular lives, but how this might echo the kind of hysteria that's going on in a culture.
Well, speaking of hysteria, you have the Rand references throughout the book, the Howard Roark stuff, which seemed to me not necessarily reminiscent of the 90s, but it seemed to tie into me towards the actual sexuality you have within this book, but simultaneously it almost sort of seemed to present, I don't know, it seemed that you were kind of juxtaposing the whole Howard Roark kind of idea of, like, intense living with the intense living of these characters, but also it almost seemed kind of as, like, a reference point for the kind of cold, almost Kathy Acker-esque sort of sexuality you have throughout this book. I was wondering if you may want to talk about this, perhaps. I mean, why make the husband an architect?
Well, actually, I have to confess that that Eris being an architect is residual from earlier incarnations of the story when there were a series of short stories that hadn't been mainly published before I ever even stumbled onto the Freud case study. So that was prior to coming up with that framework. However, it definitely was meant to be an echo of a certain type of sexuality. The idea that, you know, the way that Ayn Rand's followers and Ayn Rand's novels had the issue of sort of the idea of rape and of dominance in the sexuality, and that playing a part in Eris's psychology, yet also being something that Kirby completely objects to in her characterization of her sister's relationship. So I thought that those things, just playing with the idea of power dynamics between men and women, and as they've been portrayed in literature, as they may be held as ideology of different characters, that was interesting to me before I stumbled upon the Freud. In actuality, I just happened to know somebody who was obsessed with Howard Roark.
Well, seeing also, too, that Freud is kind of, you know, his theories have been essentially, you know, kind of thrown away into the wind, it seemed almost, I mean, they're almost sort of, Freudianism can be sort of construed as a lot of sort of, you know, constructs that don't necessarily add up, but likewise, Rand's objectivism is the same sort of situation. One can draw sort of comparisons between the two, I think.
Maybe. Yes, I definitely agree, and I think a passe view of female sexuality that nonetheless, despite being very consciously passe and something that most people would object to rationally, still exerts a certain power over people's imaginations and manages to get sort of this subculture of devotees, and that was interesting to me, the parallels between those things.
I wanted to talk about the sexuality in this book that I kind of mentioned that other question, specifically, again, to me, very reminiscent of Kathy Acker, who I know you quote here in the epigraph. To what extent was Acker an influence, and also, what steps did you take to sort of ensure that the vicious sort of sex scenes were suitably vicious? Did you want to sort of, you know, were there any sort of, did these require a lot of time for you to write or to devise, or what happened with this exactly?
Well, one of the most interesting things about the sex scenes, and predominantly, I guess, the Michael and Kendra sex scenes, is the differing ways that different readers, as I was working on the novel, perceived them and perceived the character of Michael. I had a professor in graduate school, one of my former professors, Gene Wildman, tell me that Michael wasn't nearly mean enough. And then I've had other people tell me that he's a monstrous character. So that definitely was one thing that I wanted him to be open to a lot of different interpretations as well. But I think that it turned out better than I had expected in terms of the way that people have responded to him and to the relationship with Kendra. Acker was definitely an influence, but I think that it departed from Acker for me in the writing of it, in that I think that she is really, like, kind of, you know, not pure satire, but her satire, I think, is more scathing and more conceptual than mine. I wanted the characters really to be full characters, not so much just concepts. I mean, I was working with a certain amount of theory in the book, but I don't think that it's sort of like, you know, a slam to pop culture the way that Acker is. But she definitely was an influence. I was reading a lot of Acker at the time that I was working on the short stories that originated, that came before the novel. And I think that if anything, they may have been even a little bit more influenced by Acker. They had a little bit more glibness and harshness to them. And in this novel, I tried to get people's souls in there a little bit more, where the pain would be a little bit more genuine and not just something held up as like a mocking of society. So I kind of was with her, but also trying to move a little bit in a different direction than I saw her work being, more experimental and more concept-driven than character-driven.
Okay. Well, in an interview with Todd Goldberg over at The Elegant Variation, you mentioned that you were more into classical music rather than popular music. And yet, I noticed in this book that Nine Inch Nails' Head Like a Hole actually does factor prominently into the plot. So, to what extent, I was curious, there are very artistic and musical references throughout the book, and I wanted to kind of get a sense of how much of your writing was sort of influenced by this.
Well, that's really an interesting question. I'm not a terribly musical person to begin with, as I was telling Todd, and I'm always really intimidated when male writers ask me, you know, well, what are your musical influences? And, you know, people like Steve Allman, they've got a blog going on where they talk basically about all their latest musical recommendations and such, and I, of course, have no idea who's doing what in contemporary music, who's at playing in the bar scene and blah, blah, blah. But, of course, obviously, I do occasionally come across contemporary music like anybody. And at the time that I was writing the first draft of this novel, I was living in Amsterdam, and I was listening to a lot of music, in part because I didn't really have any friends there. My husband was working there, and so I was alone a great deal of the time I was writing. This was in 1998, I guess, when I started the draft of this book. And so I was listening to a lot of music on CDs, classical, but also I listened to Tori Amos's Live from the Choir Girl Hotel repetitively. I listened to a lot of Annie DeFranco. I listened to some Nine Inch Nails. I was listening, you know, to music as kind of music with words, contemporary music, almost as a form of communication with the world, because other than that, CNN was all I had access to, which was another reason the Clinton impeachment trial probably figured so prominently, is because I was listening a lot.
Gotcha. Well, I also want to talk about the Chicago setting. Why did you, I mean, if you wrote this in Amsterdam, did sort of writing it, setting this book in Chicago, kind of, were you intending to return to Chicago, or why Chicago?
Yes, well, I'm from Chicago. I lived away for 8 years, but I'm back in Chicago now. The novel always, well, the characters always lived in Chicago in the earlier stories, and I think that it probably never occurred to me all that heavily to set it elsewhere, but the fact that I was living in Amsterdam made me even more want to set it in Chicago, because I always feel that you can kind of more vividly evoke a place when you're not there. Mm-hmm. And I had always had a little bit of an issue in my writing when I was in graduate school of kind of assuming that everyone visually saw the place, that everyone was familiar with the place. And I did stories that had taken place in Chicago in the past, and I kind of didn't really get that into the feel of the city, the visual, the concrete details of the city. And I thought being in Amsterdam and sort of longing for Chicago, even as I was loving being in Amsterdam, but Chicago being this place that had always been really important to me and that I did plan to return to someday, it made it easier to make Chicago a real concrete place in the book.
Okay. My phone is beeping, but I'm going to continue talking with you as long as it's alive, so I apologize if we somehow get cut off. Did you have difficulties shopping this novel around? How did you end up getting to Chiasmus?
Chiasmus. I had a long route to Chiasmus, and as you were saying earlier, that the sexuality in this novel is really very core and integral to the novel, and meant to be quite disturbing. And yes, sort of to answer a question that I didn't answer earlier, I did take a lot of time with the sex scenes in the novel to try to make them exactly what I wanted them to be in terms of revealing what I wanted them to reveal about character, also about the concepts in the book, and also just to read the way I wanted them to read, to be real, to be gritty, and also potentially sexy, depending on, well, I guess where your head was at. And so all of that was important to me in the writing of the book, but it was definitely something that New York was not crazy about when my agent began shopping the book. My agent, when I started shopping the book, was Bill Clegg, and he had been really behind the book and, you know, was an extremely open-minded guy. And we sent it out and basically started hearing things like, there was an editor at Houghton Mifflin who I guess said that she kept having to put the book down and leave the room. It was so disturbing. And then another editor said that he couldn't explain this book to a marketing rep without breaking down, apparently, is what he said to Bill. So it was all pretty comical. And Bill and I were a little bit astounded. We were like, what's going on? You know, and that, this was about, I don't know, maybe about 2002. So it was shortly after 9/11. You know, it was a climate where things had gotten very conservative, where people wanted entertainment to be very feel-good and very inspirational. And I think there was a real move I saw, at, you know, as the editor of Other Voices as well, from talking with other writers, I saw a real pendulum swing. Whereas in the 90s, you had writers like Kathy Acker, you had Mary Gateskill, you had, you know, a lot of female writers who were writing very sexually risky work that was being published by large houses. And it seemed to me that that was becoming less less easy, less attainable, you know, even with a good agent behind you. And ultimately, we had some really close calls, but every time an editor would want to make a bid, somebody higher up or somebody in publicity would veto them. And so eventually, you know, we stopped sending the book out around New York, and it wasn't until I was working on another novel and Lydia Kinovich, you know, was doing Chiasmus, and I knew her from Two Girls Review because she had published my work in her old magazine, and she kept saying, you know, send me the book, and finally I did, and, you know, she took it in basically about 3 days, so...
Now, I had heard an interview that you had done with Chicago Public Radio where you mentioned that apparently some of these publishers wanted to, you know, append a sort of good twin and bad twin
vibe
to this thing.
There was a lot of trouble with that. A lot of people kept saying that they didn't have sympathy with Kirby because she wasn't good enough. She was supposed to be the good twin. She was supposed to be more reliable, more pure, less deviant, less screwed up, and in contrast in every way to Kendra, and that she was too much like Kendra, even if in a more subtle way, and therefore they felt like, you know, there wasn't somebody that the reader could, you know, hold on to and relate to and empathize with. And, you know, I mean, you could take that in any variety of ways. Obviously, literature is subjective, and who people empathize with is very subjective, so that's a perfectly legitimate thing for anybody to say as a reason that they don't want a book. But on the other hand, I think that it was also happening at a time when, in literature in general, there was a sort of real push for these plucky female heroines who overcome adversity and, you know, triumph and are good, you know, in the face of bad things happening to them, and that Kirby just didn't fit the bill enough. You know, people wanted her to be that and Kendra to be the bad twin, but she just wasn't it enough.
Hmm. Do you think that maybe Chick Lit may have had something to do with this, or...?
Oh, I don't know that Chick Lit has to do with why a more literary or morally complicated novel can't find publication, but I do think that the rise of Chick Lit is definitely a symptom of the fact that editors have come to believe, whether they're right or wrong, have come to believe that the American public, particularly female readers, hence, you know, books by women, are not going to be accepting of more edgy, complicated, difficult, you know, and morally challenging or sexually, you know, risky work. I think that, you know, Chick Lit is kind of the industry's answer to that, though I think that this happens to male writers, too. I mean, in the 90s, when everything was about the PC movement, my friend Don DeGrazia had a very horrible time getting his book American Skin published. He sent it around New York for 3 years, and no one would touch it with a 10-foot pole, and kept saying, you know, no one wants to read about these racist skinheads and blah, blah, blah. And finally, the book got picked up in England. It was a big smash success, and then suddenly Scribner decided to publish it here, and next thing you know, it was a bestseller. So, you know, my personal feeling and what I always try to keep in mind at OV Books when I choose my titles is that I think that the publishing industry is full of it, effectively, that people won't accept or don't want to read or don't have a taste for this type of work. I think that there is an audience for it and that it's not minuscule, and I'm trying to get work like that out in, you know, as an editor. So, you know, in that sense, I believe in that type of literature, and that probably is why I kept writing it, even though I was having a hell of a time getting it published.
Gotcha. Now, as an editor of Other Voices, did any of this particular experience kind of tie into the writing of My Sister's Continent, or in terms of revising, or was there kind of a carryover, or...
A carryover in working at Other Voices, you mean?
Well, what I mean to say is since you were editing at Other Voices, did this have any kind of influence during the writing and revising and editing of My Sister's Continent? Or?
I think the biggest influence it has is that I have precious little time to write. it's very difficult as an editor, obviously, when you're reading sometimes maybe 30 stories a week, you know, to find time to work on your own on your fiction, and so that may, I think, always account on how long it takes to complete a project. But definitely, in my writing in general, I wouldn't say that there was anything that.
Okay, well, I lost Gina, but thank you very much. I will thank her by email. Oh, damn phone.
She was so jealous of her sister and her liberty and her smart young friends. She was so jealous of her sister. Sabella looked into the wardrobe. Priscilla looked into the fire.